This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, fantastic week yet again, and I've been on the trail of another monster.
Yet another monster.
Well, Scotland's full of monsters.
Well, in your head it is. Coming up, the EU at a house and home, leave the dirty washer lying around, but it seems that nobody really wants an empty nest.
They don't get driven out, really. We often used to think the adults chase the youngsters away, but they like each other's company. And the youngster is certainly going to be around here through the autumn and even into next season sometimes. They're still loitering like an annoying teenager who won't leave home.
More on the family politics of sea eagles coming up. Not sea eagles, but just the other day I was working on my roof and I heard swifts screaming, which means nothing to anybody else except me, other than the fact I have never, ever in 26 years seen a swift above my house. And they were swarming up then. I don't know what was causing it.
Heading down to Africa.
It's possible.
If you're listening to this outdoors podcast in Africa, can you move our swifts back, please?
please, can we have our swifts
back?
Yeah,
you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Tell us where you're listening to this podcast, because the Scotland Outdoors podcast is rocketing up the charts.
Indeed.
And we'd really like to tell your friends as well and share the goodness with the rest of the world.
You know, it is. Seriously, we're as shallow as puddles. We are dangerously close to hitting 100,000 downloads on the podcast. And for reasons which only we understand, it would make us happy if we did.
If you could log on to your granny's computer and subscribe.
Childs, anything. We don't care. Forget the whole ethics and morality of it. Just do it.
We don't get paid for it. We just do it the goodness of our heart.
Absolutely. Mull. Great place to spot whales and dolphins. And there are umpteen companies in Mull nowadays, you know, who actually take you out on whale and dolphin watching tours.
Yeah, and they're really good at actually spotting them. We were out doing basking sharks the other week.
Yeah. Well, it's always worth a go. But what they're trying to do nowadays is promote whale and dolphin watching, not from a boat, but from dry land. Carl Stevens is manager for something called the Hebridean Whale Trail, and I met him in a rather soggy Tobermory to find out more.
The Hebridean Whale and Dolphin Trust has been in existence for about 25 years, and over that time we've been working with communities and organisations all across the Hebrides, and over that time we've recorded about 23 species of whales and dolphins, which is about a quarter of the world's species. And over that time we've realised that actually it's a great place to see whales and dolphins, and what we'd like to do with a whale trail is establish a land-based opportunity for people all across the UK and wider to come to the west coast of Scotland and see these amazing places for themselves.
When you say land-based, why land-based? Why, I mean, you know, we're standing in Headland at the moment. There's a lovely old yacht crossing in front of us. Why not on something like that?
So there are a number of boat-based operators already in existence in the Hebrides, which is great. What we wanted to do was add to that mix and really make it as accessible to as many people as possible. So there are lots of places that people wouldn't necessarily think of. And I guess in terms of the Hebrides and the west coast of Scotland in general, there's an amazing diversity of habitats. So you've got these shallow beaches, you've got these secluded sea lochs, you've got big dramatic headlands, and you've got areas where the sea really becomes deep very, very quickly close to shore. So there are areas where you can see quite a high diversity of species, if you're lucky, quite close to land. So you don't necessarily have to go out if you don't want to.
Give me an idea of the range of species.
So, as I said, you have about a quarter of the world's species found in these waters. You can get things such as bottlenose dolphins, which live here all year round. So we have a number of populations. Some live around the coast of Mull. We have another population that we see often around the coast of Barra. You also have porpoises. This is an amazing place for porpoises. In fact, it's one of the European hotspots for porpoises. And then you might get your migrant species that come here during the summer. So things like minke whales and basking sharks. And if you're really lucky, you might see the bigger species like humpbacks. We get occasional sightings of those as well. So really, from everything from the small through to the big beasties.
By creating a trail, by creating these viewing spots, these viewing platforms, my concern about that was you end up with effectively a tick list. Folk are going to been there, you know, but presumably that's not what you want them to do.
No, it's probably absolutely the opposite of that, in fact. So what we're wanting to do is encourage people to visit these sites, and when they're there, really slow down. It's almost about mindfulness. On a day like today when it's raining and so on, it's probably difficult to think about being mindful. However, it's about...
the water's running down the back of your neck.
Yeah, exactly. I guess what it's about is looking out to sea and really disconnecting your brain from the sort of stresses of everyday life. So looking out at the waves, are there any different shapes that you can see? Are there any splashes? Really being very focused on the moment and really slowing down so you're experiencing this place right now and spending a significant more time here than maybe you would do.
Where we're standing is about, it's less than 100 feet above the sea. It is very wet today, as we've said, but it's not particularly blowy. There's not a lot of chop on the waves. I know Ardnamurchan's out there somewhere, but you can't see it. Would today be a good or a bad day for actually seeing activity?
To be honest, today wouldn't be a bad day. Obviously, from a human perspective, it's raining, so we assume it must be terrible, but obviously these things live in the water and it's wet. So, in fact, if anything, we're extending their habitat, which is fantastic. And the sea state is the most important element, as you say, because this isn't too bad, so you still might be able to see some of the smaller species, such as porpoises. You'd almost certainly be able to see dolphins if they're out there and any of the bigger species. So, yeah, this is actually not too bad a day.
Where is your, I mean, you're thinking back of all the stuff you've seen, where's your best sighting? Where was it? What was it of?
Do you know, weirdly, it was here in Tobermory, and I guess it was, I'd been on Mull for a couple of months. I'd not really seen much. It was a wet day like today, and there was a call in the office that there were bottlenose dolphins in the harbour, and we all rushed out, and sure enough, there were about 7 bottlenose dolphins leaping around in the water.
That must have stopped the street.
It was unbelievable, and that's the wonderful thing about whales and dolphins, is that they kind of bring people together. So everybody suddenly started talking and there were squeals of excitement. So grown-ups forgot they were grown-ups for a second and started getting excited, chatting to people. Obviously, when they left, everybody became very grown-up and adult again. But for that few moments with these bottlenose dolphins leaping around, it was fantastic. And seeing them so close, it kind of shows you how big these things are, because the ones that we get around here are some of the biggest in the world, up to nearly 4 metres. So they're big, you know, and seeing them so close with the backdrop of Tobermory is quite a special sort of situation to see them, really.
I was trying to think, and was on Lewis, watching basking sharks, you know, just in this little bay, and that became hypnotic.
Yeah.
Because the sun was going down, everything was sort of really sort of oranges and reds and yellows and things like that, aside from these really jet black. It looked like 2 sharks swimming in tandem, but obviously what you've got is the dorsal fin and then the tail fin sticking out at the same time. There was 5 of them.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
It's amazing. Yeah. I've seen basking sharks before and they are hypnotic, and there's something quite prehistoric about them, especially if you can see them in quite calm water. There's something, they've got quite small brains, but they're this enormous creature and they glide so slowly. However, if you're lucky enough to see one leap straight out of the water, which they do occasionally, that takes your breath away. I mean, you see this enormous beast jumping out of the water and, yeah, you can't really forget a moment like that.
Where have you actually located these viewing spots? And how integrated have the communities been?
So they've been very integrated from day one. It's very much a grassroots project in that respect. So we have sites from Cape Wrath in the north down to Arran in the south and out to St Kilda. And what we've done over the past couple of years, I work very closely with communities all across the Hebrides to look at places that we can locate the spaces. You know, we want to make sure that where we go, people are happy for us to have a whale trail site. We also want to make sure that the communities and the organisations there help us tell the stories, because these are the people who live in the area, so they know the places better. But also we want to make sure that there's a legacy, so the whale trail lives through these communities moving forward.
Yeah, it'd be interesting that actually, just if you had, say, several generations who'd lived in that location for a while, what they remembered three generations ago and what they're seeing nowadays.
Absolutely, and that's another part of the Whale Trail, which is about the cultural and the historical heritage, because obviously you can see, potentially, hopefully see stuff out there, but when it comes to the Hebrides, there's a real strong connection between the sea and people in the sea, and that's been going back for eons. You know, you have examples of whale bones that have been burnt in sites down in the Uists, for example. You have carvings of this Pictish beast all across Scotland, which is it's like a bottlenose dolphin-esque shape. Then you have the sort of more modern whaling, which happened on the Outer Hebrides through to tourism today. So it's had a really important part in people's lives. And because of that, you often hear song, art, and all sorts of things that whales and dolphins and the sea are really integral to. And that helps us tell that story and make it mean a lot more to people as well.
Carl Stevens, Hebridean Whale Trail Manager. Now, not on the West Coast, but, you know, actually on the Murray Firth, there is this dolphin centre in Spey Bay.
Yep, the Whale and Dolphin.
Yeah, been there umpteen times.
Never seen
I've never seen anything. Went up there with my wife the other day and I said, it's a bit of a con, this, because they say whale and dolphin and I never see anything. She says, but there's dolphins out there. And there were.
Yeah,
we watched them for about half an hour.
I've spoken to some of the folk that work there, and they do see them really regularly.
Yeah,
so
it's just us.
There's a good chance you will see them, but there's a lot of dolphins in the Murray Firth.
It is something that, you know, we really enjoy in this podcast when one story kind of leads into another. About a year ago, I spoke to another Mark who had an interest for some reason in gasometers. So you've got to be interested in something. It's a large container. I mean, basically it is heritage industrial architecture, this large container where gas was stored. He was photographing them using pinhole cameras, which is an interesting idea. Now, it sparked a bit of a discussion about gasworks, and then we discovered that Biggar is home to a rather unique relic, which I'd never even heard of. Adrian Cox from Historic Environment Scotland showed me around.
Well, this is the last surviving small-town gasworks in Scotland, and it's a wee gem because it's largely complete, and it's almost just as it was the day it closed in 1973. And, of course, it was a coal gasworks, and so it was a victim of that big changeover that we had in the 1960s and 1970s to natural gas from the North Sea. So that eventually resulted in its closure. But for 100 years or more, this place would have served the inhabitants of Biggar and supplied them with gas, which was really important for lighting, really important for their cooking, etc. In fact, it probably changed their lives.
We've got a couple of tanks here, one immediately in front of us and a larger one across there, just the other end of the sort of patch.
Yeah.
These are actually quite tiny. You see the one, say, for example, beside the motorway in Glasgow, and it's huge,
works,
10 times bigger.
Works the same way, though. They are sort of upside-down, open-ended cylinders floating in water, and these would have contained the gas. Uh-huh. Once it has been gone through a purification stage, which is a lengthy process, which is what most of the buildings in here are designed to do, to clean the gas. But once it's cleaned, it's then ready to go out to people's homes, and these big heavy bells would contain the gas, and by gravity they would push it into the mains pipes. Be enough pressure that if you lived on the edge of Biggar, you'd have a reasonable flame coming out of a pipe at the end. So it works simply by gravity. It's really quite an ingenious thing. And the water in the bottom, if we move slightly closer, you'll see it's full of water in here. This is like a big tank.
Uh-huh.
And that's just topped up by natural rainwater.
Right.
But that effectively acts as a seal, so uh-huh. The gas can't escape from the bell. It's called.
It's clever. Listen.
That's it. And this is, of course, it's got to be very, very strong to contain the gas. So this is half a centimetre thick steel. Uh-huh. And I was inside about 10 years ago. We did some conservation work inside uh-huh. because every part of this complex has needed some TLC over the years. So we went inside, we introduced sort of cathodic protection in the form of zinc strips so mm-hmm. that the elements would attack that rather than the structure itself.
Sacrificial and it was like, rusting.
That's right, exactly that.
It suddenly came back to me after about 40 years in physics.
Sacrificial rusting, yeah, that's exactly it. But it's another world in there, obviously. It's dark and it smells very strongly of the gas and tar and all those sort of waste products. But
where did they actually make the gas?
Well, I'll show you. Let's go around the corner and show you how this works. It's basically made from coal.
Uh-huh.
So the gas is derived from the heating of coal in things called retorts. Mm-hmm. And we're just coming round to the retort house, which has several of these retorts. So it's fired
Oh, wow.
to a very high temperature. This little building we've just come up to is the meter house, and this 1950s meter measured how much gas they were producing in here.
See, the reason I'm stepping in here is because I caught a whiff of the smell.
Yeah, that's right.
That is so distinctive.
Yeah, it's hydrogen sulfide smell. Uh-huh. Yeah. So this thing would have whirred round and round, measured how much gas they were making, and that would have been huge amounts, huge quantities. In 1911, they published some figures. They were using 400 tons of coal to light about 100 gas lights in the town, and they had 230 to 250 customers as well.
How so long did 400 tons of coal?
A year.
A year.
Yeah.
A year.
So that's a lot, really.
How safe was coal gas? Or town gas, that was the other name of it.
Town gas, yeah. Well, if you think of a cotton mill, which would have been full of oil-soaked cotton lit by candles, the introduction of gas into that kind of environment made it a lot safer at the time, if we're talking sort of late 19th, early 20th century. So that's how gas spread very quickly. At first, the manufacture of it was for individual buildings and factories. So it kind of powered the Industrial Revolution in a kind of way. Much, much safer. So the insurers of the mills, they would lower their premiums if you introduced gas lighting. And then the invention of the gas mantle, the little glowing thing, made it even better. I'll just show you the retort house, Mark, around the corner. This is where it all begins, in here. These are the big retorts. So manually, by hand, you see all these barrows, etc. You'd have a few guys working in here, shoveling coal into these long tubes, which are made of fire clay, so they're very insulated. Big cast iron doors, the thing is slammed shut, and then furnaces underneath powered by coal, and in fact later on coke, just heated these furnaces to a very high temperature. Okay. And then the gas that comes off contains lots of impurities. It contains ammonia, tar, lots of toxic things like carbon monoxide, etc.
Stuff you don't really want in your house.
Stuff you don't want at all. So all of that goes up with these pipes and then goes through a whole process right around the plant, which involves cleaning it in various ways.
Uh-huh. What strikes me about this is the fact that it is proper Victorian engineering. It's industrial-grade engineering, and it's all still here.
It's all still here.
How was this able to survive when so many of them disappeared?
The process happened very, very quickly in the 1960s and 70s. You might remember, Mark, you know, natural gas was introduced. People went round the houses and they changed everybody's gas supply. And so coal gas went out of fashion very, very quickly. A lot of these plants were just taken down and demolished. But in 1973, when this one closed, it was lucky enough to be smallish and out of the way in a convenient
location.
It's
kind of
location.
On the outskirts.
That's right. And local enthusiasts in bigger, and there are a few of them still, campaigned for this one to be saved. So a joint project was put together between ourselves, Historic Environment Scotland, and the National Museums of Scotland to preserve this one and open it as a visitor attraction. Yeah. So it's a lucky survivor.
Go ahead, back out a second. I have to confess, Adrian, I did not know this was here. I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard anybody speaking about it. I struggled to find it. You walk up a side road to actually access this. It's as if you're coming out the back of somebody's garden.
That's right.
It's a best-kept secret, basically.
It is. It is. It's in the lowest part of the town, which was great for distributing the gas. It's great that it's down here by the river. There's the bigger burn runs alongside it. It's at the end of people's back gardens. So it is kind of invisible as you go through the town, but it's a real gem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's just show you another part of the process. Yeah, these are the big condenser tubes. Uh-huh. This is how the tar was extracted. So that's the tar well there. Uh-huh. Basically, the gas goes up and down these tubes and cools, and then the tar settles out, collected, and then siphoned off. And these things are called gas purifiers.
Uh-huh.
And they are full of iron oxide. And when the gas is passed through that iron oxide, it's like bog ore, if you know. Mm-hmm. It removes the hydrogen sulfide, and it's these things that are creating the eggy smell.
Yes, right. And it's a considerable eggy smell.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, that all stopped over 40 years ago, you know, so it's still around.
And it's still there. Do they ever fire any of this up?
They do, yeah. They fire up the boiler, and they get all this electrical equipment going. The belt drives turn, and so people can see at least some of the process working, and it's a nice sort of clackety-clack noise that it makes. again, local enthusiasts come along and they start it up, and visitors can see at least part of the process working to this day, which is great. People really enjoy it.
I just had a mental image there of a group of enthusiasts, nostalgists, you might call them, gathering round a little gas mantle and sniffing appreciatively.
Yes, that's right.
Ah, pistol.
That's right, yes. Well, people do like that sort of smell of tar and bitumen, don't they? It's quite nice. This is quite a nice smell, but you'd been able to smell the gasworks. It's great.
Adrian Cox from Historic Environment Scotland there. And I must confess, I envy him the fact that he's actually been inside the gasometer.
Yeah.
I think that would make a great noise.
Because if you don't know what they are massive circular structures that used to move up and down with the volume of the gas, but they're just great things.
Yeah.
Fantastic venue for a fringe show in Edinburgh because they're running out of them rapidly.
They'll be doing them in taxis and buses and phone boxes next. Let's go indoors briefly now, because there is actually a major new exhibition in Edinburgh right now addressing an issue which is central to the management of the Scottish countryside. We've spoken to artist and composer Hannah Tuilike a few times in Out of Doors. In her latest work, which is called Deer Dancer, she creates five different deer characters based on her research into the copying of deer in dance across the globe. Now, as you'll hear, she's using these characters to trigger a debate on the whole issue of deer stalking, masculinity of all things, and the environment. Helen Needham went along to her installation at the Edinburgh Printmakers.
We've got the monarch, who wears a 16-tine crown made from recycled leather and red deer antlers. So there's 16 points to this, like the monarch of the glen.
This is a beautiful, beautiful costume, and that's the deer skin that you're using.
Yeah, so this is deer hide from an estate in Fife, which has been tanned naturally with bark. I can't remember which bark it was now, by a local tanner in Fife. And this is a cod piece made from deer hide as well, with some gold furniture tassels hanging there.
It's not often you see a cod piece these days, Hannah.
No, there's a number of cod pieces. Well, there's three cod pieces and one sporran in this show. And this is sequins, gold sequins. Yeah.
The deer fascination, tell me about that.
I am interested in how our relationship with deer across cultures constructs ideas of wilderness. So wilderness being an imaginary landscape that's very different to the actual damaged ecologies that are of now. So I've been researching dances from around the world, traditional dances from around the world, that are mimetic of deer, so they imitate the movements of deer, looking at how these ideas of wilderness are kind of encoded in the dances, and then also how these dances encode particular forms of masculinity. They're all performed by men traditionally, and these forms of masculinity draw on the behaviours and the gestures of male deer. So from the kind of bravado and display of the stag to the kind of capering of the fawn and the, you know, this real alertness of the male deer. Basically, in this work, I'm looking at the interconnections between the crisis of ecology and the crisis of masculinity, and how they're linked. I've also been looking a lot at traditional hunting practices. A lot of the dances have their origins in hunting practices, so rituals around hunting. So I was spending a lot of time up at Trees for Life in Dundregan, going out with the stalker there and learning about the practice of stalking, and actually began to notice how much the stalker almost becomes like the deer in his alertness and his posture, even, you know, like bending from the torso, getting lower and lower into the ground. I guess I've begun to think about the work as a life crisis ritual for a damaged planet. And there are five characters. There's the monarch, who we're looking at just now, the warrior, the young buck, the fool and his hobby stag, and the old sage.
Why do you think it is that men in particular have such a historical fascination with deer?
I think that it's a cultural construction. I think there's a romanticisation around the hunt and the hunt being kind of becoming a sport or trophy hunting. But really, in Scotland in particular, there's an overpopulation of deer. So there are no predators, for one, because they were hunted out. And secondly, we cut down all the trees. But now the trees can't grow because the deer eat them all. But we continue to have this overpopulation of deer because we don't have any predators, but also because it supports the hunting economy. So basically, quite wealthy men, more often than not, come up to Scotland, they pay to go out in a Land Rover, point and shoot, and then carry home their trophy.
And why you, as a female, and I know that you live in the city, artist, why are you so interested in this particular subject? Because it's a very hot topic, certainly within rural Scotland at the moment, the whole thing and the balance and how we go about managing the land and the notion of rewilding.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big question. Why, as a female, through my experiences of particular performances of masculinity that I have experienced as a woman, I have been interested in how those forms of masculinity are encoded in these cultural practices of stalking and then also in these dances. So that's from my perspective in my body and my experiences in the world. It's all connected. Our climate is connected through the world. The furthest I've been to research is in Mexico and Arizona in the Sonora Desert. So I was looking at a dance of the Yaqui tribe, who are a tribe originally from the Sonora Desert in Mexico, but a lot of the community were forced to migrate north of the border initially due to persecution by the Mexican government. I mean, the Sonoran Desert is really under threat from climate change, from climate breakdown, and it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter there. I've also been looking at the Abbots Bromley Horn Dance, which is a village. So Abbots Bromley is a village in Staffordshire in England. Then the Highland Fling in Scotland.
Yeah, I never even thought about the Highland Fling in that way before.
Okay, so it's actually a little bit of fake lore. So there is a story that the Highland Fling is imitative of the stag rut, you know, with the hands held aloft like antlers.
Like antlers.
Uh-huh. But I have discovered through my research that the dance is actually choreographed by a lowlander as a kind of caricature of a Highland savage, you know, like this wild man. And this dance has become encoded in Scottish culture as, you know, the dance of Scotland. In this work, I'm unpicking some of these layers of cultural construction and the way that over time things become romanticised. And I think our relationship with the deer is really, in Scotland, part of that romanticisation.
Hannah Tuoliki showing Helen Needham around our latest exhibition. Deer Dancers On at the Edinburgh Printmakers Fountain Bridge now until early October, and we'll be publishing an extended version of that interview as the Scotland Outdoors podcast a week on Wednesday.
It's really interesting, that relationship between animals and dance as well. Because, I mean, there's many, many instances of that, obviously, like the Highland Fling and whatever. But I've told you this before, but I'm going to bore you with it again. The Greek plate breaking dance.
Yes.
Where they chuck plates around and dance around. Thought of its origins in the crane. The big bird that you'll see throughout Europe and occasionally in Scotland. They just started breeding here. And in part of the mating ritual, they throw things at each other. They leap up in the air and they'll chuck a divot of mud at the other person.
Okay. Other crane.
Yeah, the other crane. And it's thought that was actually the inspiration of man imitating the wildlife. Maybe nonsense, but it's a good theory.
There was. This is about 20 years ago. There was, for some reason, an Australian Aboriginal dance group came to Inch in Aberdeenshire, and I went to watch them. And a lot of their dance was based on mimicking animals. And it was fascinating. I mean, you know, without introducing it at all, you could actually see what it was they were trying. Yeah, all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, there'll be a whole show on that in the Fringe.
We do like hearing where you listen to this podcast. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Jan Vos from Fervert in the Netherlands did. He said,
yeah, the German Autobahn can be terribly boring. Well, I don't know about that. You can go, there's no speed limit. Fantastic.
Yeah, that gets boring too after a while.
Yeah. Because of my work, I have to drive to and from Germany on a regular basis. During these hours, I love listening to your podcast. Well, thank you. I was lucky enough to live in the southwest of Scotland between 1983 and 97. What struck me over the years is the similarity between Dutch and Scottish words. To name a few, the Dutch word for drill is boer or boar. Mm-hmm. Church is a kerk, and a wooden box is a kist. There's a lot of Norwegian ones as well.
Yes.
We've a word for a grape is a fork, uh-huh. But we call it a grape here in the northeast as well. Bairns as well.
Mm-hmm. Would they their word for a vacuum cleaner, stursuker?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And they, you know, and Norwegian builders are known as biggers.
Right.
You know, we big things up here in the northeast. So,
fascinating.
Anyway, more and more we're coming across community groups taking charge of their own patch of, you know, wildlife heaven. Earlier in the summer, I visited one such organisation with a brilliant acronym, BOGWIG, Boat of Garden Wildlife Group, and chatted to their chair, Alan Bantick, along with member Kate Johnson and secretary Heather Bantick. And yes, Heather and Alan are married.
The wildlife group is part of the Boater Garten community company. And one of the objects of the community company is the promotion and enhancement of the environment. So the wildlife group exist to do these two things, promote and enhance the environment. And very recently we became the owners of Milton Loch, which is the loch in the woodlands that we see behind us. Since looking after the loch, we've managed to put in on this side, where you're standing now, officially this is a dragonfly platform. Okay. And the idea that was that it would link with a trail that the RSPB were building from here to Loch Garten. But actually, it's known locally as the duck feeding platform. And I'm really surprised that the ducks haven't arrived.
Yeah,
they normally come in great numbers as soon as anybody arrives here.
Kate, what's your role in this?
I help look after the loch and oversee the amazing volunteers who help in so many ways. So we look after the woodland over there, and we try and maintain this feature to be the best for wildlife, but also an environment that locals and visitors can enjoy.
How did you actually inherit it? Where did it come from?
It was originally owned by the Reedhaven estate.
It was the village skip at one time, dump.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah, over
I think
there.
The estate were happy to give it to the community council.
Yeah.
And they've been advised they shouldn't hold land, things like that. So they gifted it to the community company.
Okay.
We have charity status, so we've got limited liability and things like that. So it's safe enough for us to have it.
And you can also access grants and things in a way that quite a lot of other bodies can't.
Yes, absolutely. Which is, I think, the reason you've picked up on us getting a grant. We've got a grant to do what we're calling an osprey nest for the osprey village.
Uh-huh.
We hope to build an osprey platform. Whether they'll ever use it or not, we don't know. But we're known as the osprey village, and that seems all wrong not to have ospreys in the village. The closest ones are at Loch Garten, which is quite a bit out of the village. So when visitors arrive, they say, where's the ospreys?
Perfectly understandable. It's an interesting idea, essentially having a small local nature reserve owned by the community.
I don't know of any other example of that. Perhaps we're very fortunate. The circumstances have just led us to this happy place. I think already the Boater Garten Wildlife Group has a good reputation of achieving all sorts of bits and pieces. It's very much self-sustaining financially in most respects.
Mm-hmm.
The badger hide attracts donations from people who visit the hide, and that money provides core day-to-day funding for the various projects that we have.
How much of a virtuous circle is this? And by that I mean, you know, it's easy to see a project like this as we are benefiting nature. But you're not just benefiting nature, you know, it's the community at the same time.
It is the community. You see a lot of people coming here to watch the birds here. We get a good variety of wildlife here. So people come. So they then go to the local shop, they go to the pub, they use the other local facilities. The children are able to use it here safely, and we have a pond dipping platform over the other side. So the local children and visiting children are able to interact with nature safely, positively. So it really does give so much. It's not just beautiful to drive nearby, which it is, but it also attracts visitors to the village and helps to generate funds in local businesses, which is fantastic.
What's the plan for the future for this place? How do you see it developing?
Well, we're always looking ahead, and I think an example of that is this hope for the Osprey platform and also the other things that we'll be doing to this loch.
Well, yes, the dam, this was originally a mill pond for the village and for the mills that were so crucial locally. Obviously, while it doesn't power the mills anymore, we still need to keep it. Had an incredibly dry summer last year, and the leak in the dam, which doesn't matter when it's raining like it's raining on us at the moment, really mattered, and we had very little water left in the loch. So a large part of the funding will go to actually rebuilding and plugging that leak.
Yeah. I have to say, just listening to the birdsong in the background, and even the sun's come out now, it's still raining, but the sun's come out now, and you're getting this dimpled patterns in the water. All these little islands, all the growth, this time of year, it's so green at the moment. It's just, it's a bonny, bonny place. Mm.
Well, Scotland is green because of the rain, and it's, yeah. And it's sort of very much out of character when we get a dry spell. And some of the wildlife actually is really disadvantaged by dry weather because they have evolved in this sort of wet, damp environment.
Would all of this have happened? Would the community have been behind this? Would there have been the drive to do it if you hadn't been sitting within a national park?
Possibly not. We would have done as much as we could by raising funds ourselves. And we do have a small pot of money. And I'm sure you understand how this kind of thing works, that if you have some money, you can apply for
more.
Stuff.
Yeah.
You can leverage more. Well put. And so whenever you get a grant like this, they always say to you, what's your contribution to this? Well, I think very much because of the badger hide, we do have a small pot of money where we can say, well, we can offer this. So I think that's very helpful.
The villages and the wildlife group existed before the national park. So there is, within the village, there is an interest, a keenness to do things for the environment.
And a keen group of volunteers who turn out once every 2 months, not just because they're married to me and so I encourage them to do things.
They're not all married to me.
Exactly. So they, you know, there's a good group that turn up and do all sorts of brilliant tasks in some pretty foul weather sometimes as well. And quite often there'll be somebody out there in waders pulling reeds out or cutting something down. So yeah, it's a really good group of people who are behind us.
One of the things that we need money for on a regular basis is the feeding stations. We have one here at Milton Loch, we have three in the woods, and of course there's the badger hide where we scatter peanuts for the badgers. And you can imagine that peanuts are quite expensive. So
I don't need to imagine it.
Yeah,
that's right. I know, Alan.
I'm sure you do. Yeah, so you probably feed birds at your own place. So we're on a much bigger scale of stuff here. So we're buying, you know, these 25 kilo bags probably once a fortnight, and so that needs funding. And it's the visitors to the badger hide that provide the funding for that. Adults, we ask for a donation. Young people go free because we just hope we plant a seed in these young people and that they'll maybe never forget their experience of close encounter with a live badger.
Alan and Heather Bantick and Kate Johnson of Bogwig there. Now, bear in mind, the community they're in is called Boat of Garton, B-O-G. The local community newsletter is known as the Bog Standard. How brilliant is that?
The Bog Myrtle.
Yeah, too straight.
They must have been really chuffed with that, or really were at 5 pints in.
I know what we'll call it. We'll call it the Bog Standard. If you were listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast last week, you may have heard Ewan's tale of the Stronsay Beast, which turned out to be probably the decomposing remains of a basking shark. Now, if you missed any of the podcasts we've done in the past, you can get them on the BBC Sounds app, as you probably know already. But this week, you've got another tale of monsters.
Yeah, I'm not going to make this a regular thing, because you can
I think is a mistake. I think you should.
Yeah, but not every week. But the Beast of Stronsay reminded me of one of the first stories I ever wrote about. I was working on oil rigs at the time, desperately trying to get out of it. I wanted to be a journalist. Still hasn't happened. And I was writing stories and sending them off. And one of the ones I sent off 35 years ago was published in the Scots Magazine. And I was so excited that I've still got the cheque framed above my desk at home.
It's probably out of date now.
If you drive the twisting, turning road from Melyn Udrigal to Alt Bay on the shores of Loch Ewe, you can take in the stunning beach, probably one of the finest on the west coast, the rugged open moorland,
and the flower-carpeted Macker. But few give the small loch, just a few hundred yards off the road, a second glance. But it's a special piece of water, and 180 years ago was the scene of great terror and fear. For if you look it up on the Ordnance Survey map of today, you'll see it's still known as Loch na Beastie, the Loch of the Beast, the Water Horse. Now, local opinion varies as to whether this animal existed or not, but the attempts to get rid of it were very real indeed, and the marks of the task remain to this day. On the afternoon of 1840, Sandy MacLeod, an elder in the church, was returning from the service in Alt Bay in the company of two others. As they crossed over the heather track to Melyn Udrigal, they skirted the small loch. Suddenly, from the water emerged a beast, which they later described as having the body the size of an upturned boat, a long, elongated neck, and fins upon which the beast walked. Understandably, the three fled the scene, fearing for their lives. And the next day, when another Free Church elder, Kenneth Cameron, saw the beast, local folk had had enough. A deputation was sent to the local landowner, a Mr. Banks, and demanded action. The owner was a little sceptical, to say the least, and fobbed them off with promises to look into the matter. But the sightings continued, and finally the pressure of local folk and the church persuaded Mr. Banks to take action. There were tales of dynamite being lobbed into the loch, with massive explosions and huge plumes of water, but no sign of the beast. But this time the landowner was becoming obsessed as well. Now, Banks had a boat named the Iris. James Mackenzie was a sailor on the boat, and he, along with another sailor named Alan Mackenzie, worked to cut a channel in the rock to try and drain it. But the rock was too hard, and finally, that scheme was abandoned. Then Mr. Banks bought a large pump with two horses to work it, with the object of emptying the loch. The pump was placed on the burn which runs from the loch into the not too far distant sea, and a number of pipes were provided for the purpose of conducting the water away. James Mackenzie often attended the pump, and he and others were employed for the best part of 2 years in the attempt to try and empty the loch, or as James Mackenzie puts it, to ebb it up. But still no sign of the beast. In desperation, the Iris was sent to Broadford in Skye to procure lime. James Mackenzie went with her. They brought from Broadford 14 barrels of raw lime. They came with the lime to Udrigal, and it was taken up to the loch of the beast, and the small dinghy of the Iris was also taken up. They went in the boat over every part of the loch, which had been reduced in places to only 6 or 7 inches after all the labour had been spent in it. They plumbed the loch with oars, and in no part did it exceed 6 feet in depth, except in one hole which the oars couldn't reach. Into this hole they put the 14 barrels of lime. Nothing could survive that amount of lime. But still, no sign of the beast. It didn't rise to the surface and was never seen again. Did it exist? Who knows? It's a lonely, quiet spot, and if you visit today, the chances are you'll see no sign of the beast. But the channels that were cut into the rock to lower the water to catch the beast are still there for all to see. And for the folk of Melyn Udrigal in the 1840s and 50s, it was very real indeed.
Welcome to Castle Dracula.
Now, that's production. When I was a BBC journalist at Radio Journalism School, they never taught you you could put music like that on a piece.
Absolutely. And we have to thank our audio supremo, Ron McCaskill, for that.
Imagine you could really... Well, imagine the 6 o'clock news. Yeah. You could really... Brexit.
Finishing the minor chord. Boom. Anyway, white-tailed seagulls were reintroduced to Mull in the 1970s after becoming extinct at the turn of the century. Since the mid-80s, they've successfully bred on the island, and this year the nest is, to say the least, in a rather interesting location, as I found out when I met the RSPB officer for Mull, Dave Sexton.
We are at Craigmuir Golf Course on the Isle of Mull. Golf's been played here since 1895, so before the original population of sea eagles became extinct. They were probably flying over this place with a few Victorians knocking a golf ball around. But here we are still, and it's a fantastic nine-hole course, and it's the only golf course in the world where you can be pretty guaranteed of a double eagle.
Oh, all together now. I was mystified because I drove past it last night and it said Mull Eagle Watch, Craigmuir Golf Club. It's not what you expect, really.
It isn't, but it does also show how these big predators can settle in alongside us, really. You know, it's not the busiest golf course in the world, but there's people out here playing. But the birds are used to that sort of human activity, and they're used to us being on the boundaries of the golf course. And so we're going to walk just around the edge of the coast here. Tern's going mad out here as well, yeah, to our left.
It's actually quite an active wee area. I mean, the golf course has a small river, almost a burn, running through it. There's estuary there with weed on it, seaweed.
Yeah.
So you've got geese, blackback gulls, oyster catchers, terns, you name it. Tons of stuff.
It's a fantastic mixture of things for our visitors to look at, but it's obviously another reason why the sea eagles are here. Because with the geese, Canada geese, grey-legged geese, all good prey items that they're going to take advantage of.
How have the eagles been doing this year? I ask because I'm fairly certain we're not going to see one today.
You never know. During the incubation period and the hatching phase in May, we had fantastic weather. So they're going to have a good season. I mean, we're looking at the moment, I've probably still got 15 young chicks still on the go.
Okay.
Nearly on the point of fledging, not quite there yet. One or two have gone, but yeah, it's going to be a good year. But that, you know, that's fairly average now. It's been pretty stable now for the last 5 years.
And when they fledge, how big are they?
Fully grown. I think they go, literally, they go from coming out of the egg, and the egg's sort of a goose-size egg. They go from that to fully grown in 10 weeks with a 2.5-metre wingspan for a female.
Yeah.
It is a phenomenal rate of growth. And you kind of, you know, when you say a chick's just fledging, you think it's still going to keep growing for a few years. But no, they are, they're as big as they're going to get. Obviously, look different. They're dark brown, nothing like the adults. But let's pull in here. This is a little shelter we've got just on the edge of the golf course. Get out of this drizzle and see what we can see.
Yeah.
I'm just going to set up the scope here. And if you can look straight into the middle of that wood, Mark, the highest point is a Scots pine. Mm-hmm. You come just down from the canopy. There's a dark clump.
I can see it on the right-hand side, basically, of that aperture.
Okay. Exactly, and that's the nest. And it's a nest this pair of white-toed eagles have been in now for 6 years, and they've done very well here. Few failures, as ever, but we'll just see if there's anything visible.
When did sea eagles come back to Mull?
So it was the late 70s, really. The first reintroduction, the phase one, was on the Isle of Rum between 75 and 85. And it was really from the late 70s, early 80s, that people started seeing and reporting this suddenly this big bird floating over places like Loch Don. That was one of the first areas. And it's kind of grown gradually ever since then. Now, the first nests were on Mull as well in the mid-80s. And the first chick was here in 1985. And you know, that was the beginning of a very long conservation story, bringing this bird back after its extinction 101 years ago. And they're now back, and we've got, across Scotland now, a minimum of 120 pairs. And last year, 75 chicks fledged. So it's a bird that's doing well. Mull Eagle Watch has been running now for nearly 20 years, and it is, I think, a beacon of how you can work with a species which is not everyone's favourite bird, as we well know, but it can bring benefits to a local economy. People, even yesterday, someone was here, just come to Mull specifically and only for this eagle, Mull Eagle Watch trip at the golf course they'd come across for the day, spent money during lunch on local goods and services, on the ferry. So, yeah, there is a role for these birds. It shouldn't just be about an economic value, of course. It's also just that, I don't know, that well-being, that almost spiritual thing that people get out of seeing
a magnificent bird like a white-toed eagle sitting atop a Scots pine on a sunny day. It lifts their spirits, it does something for their soul, and I think that has to have a role as well as the economic benefit.
It's almost a rule of thumb in ecology that life attracts life. Chances are more species will come because you have that species. To a certain extent, it's counterintuitive because it's a big predator. You'd think it would knock things out.
Well, again, and you end up hear lots of stories of things that they've allegedly wiped out, and it is myths. This bird has surrounded with myths and stories about what it allegedly does to its local environment. But it's here, right in the middle of a very rich habitat. As we can hear, there's terns, there's waders, there's wildfowl, the geese, right out in the Sound of Mull here. That's why they're here. Of course, the thing that they kill and prey and eat, that's gone, but that they are top of this healthy food chain. They have that role, and that's why they should be here. And so they are now affecting the goose numbers here, and they're keeping them off these golfing greens as well, which goes down quite well. So they've got that role. They don't, you know, there are still ptarmigan on Mull, there are still hares, all these things that we often hear have been removed by white-toed eagles. It's just one of those things. They're a bird that evokes that sort of love-hate relationship almost.
You sound reconciled to that.
Well,
10 years ago when I spoke to you, you weren't. But now you think, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
I think it is probably the way it's going to be. This bird, if you look back in history, has had so much folklore and stories written about it, from carrying off babies to goodness knows what else. And it's just one of those things, I think, it's a fear, really, that people have with a big predator. We don't have many in Scotland or the UK as a whole. And so when something like this comes back, it unnerves people a little bit, and until we do start to get used to it. And it's been 40 years now, so people on Mull are quite used to them being around. Some people are not even going to look up when one flies over, but if you're a visitor, to see something like an eagle is mind-blowing for some people.
You seeing anything?
Well,
other than rain.
You have a look through. You can see the dark mass, but it is literally in thick fog.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's a study in monochrome, I think, is a reasonable assessment of it. Could be anything in that.
Well, I tell you what we hope is in there. There was yesterday anyway, is a 9.5-week-old chick. Uh-huh. And so that bird is pretty much full grown. And it'll be, when things dry out a bit, it'll be wing flapping and exercising and getting ready for its maiden flight. And the adults will be around somewhere. They usually, for our visitors, they often sit at the top of that pine and get fantastic views. They get mobbed by the hooded crows and passing gulls, and they just kind of, you know, look up and ignore them. But eventually this bird, I say maiden flight, it's not exactly as dramatic as it sounds, because they normally hop onto a branch and then on another branch and then nearly always end up on the ground. And these eagles, chicks, are walking around for several days, very ungainly and strange to see. But eventually, bit by bit, they get stronger, braver, and start exercising and going a little bit further. So I would say by August, really, this chick will be up and about and flying like an eagle should. And yeah, they'll eventually hang around here probably right through the autumn. So Mull Eagle Watch is going to carry on to the end of September, because the birds just, they don't get driven out, really. We often used to think the adults chase the youngsters away, but I've never seen that, really. They're very tolerant and sociable as eagles go. They like each other's company, and the youngster is certainly going to be around here through the autumn, and even into next season sometimes. They're still loitering like an annoying teenager who won't leave home.
Dave Sexton, RSPB officer for Mull. And in all the years we've spoken to Dave, in all the years we've gone to Mull, never once has he failed to show a sea eagle.
What,
and there may
know?
Have been a sea eagle in that
nest. You don't
nest.
Know if it failed, you couldn't see it.
I just couldn't see it. There were several tons of water between the telescope and the nest. It was just impossible.
It was a bit ironic, because we independently were both on Mull at the same time. I was there the next day. And as we were coming in the boat from, well, it was Tyree we were on, coming back round the corner at, what's the big castle? Castle Gorm.
Yes. And as you say.
Yes.
Dracula's Castle.
Dracula's Castle. Coming round the Tobermory, and a sea eagle came down. I kid you not, took a fish about 50 yards from the boat. It was fantastic. Yeah. And then I was getting off the island, getting off the Fishnish to Corn Ferry, the shortcut, and there was two eagles seagulls just circling above us, waiting for the ferry to come in. I was looking around, and the sun was on the mountains, the water was like glass. You got the black and white ferry coming across, you got two seagulls above you. What a good job this is.
I said, we were 24 hours apart on Mull, right? If that had happened the day I was there, the last day I was on Mull, it could have landed and caught a fish 50 metres away, I would have been none the wiser.
Yes.
It was foul weather. Well, certainly wasn't sea eagle weather. That's all we've got time for this week in the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. We will bring up another one next week. Until then, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.